This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. Best bits from Wednesday, March the 20th. Busy old show, as usual. And we had a bit of breaking news whilst we were on air. Dubai inflation numbers coming in. Brandy and Richard crunching those numbers for us. Also, looking locally, we got the latest from those cabinet meeting minutes. There was one particular line in those minutes that prompted a lot of interest in the insurance industry here. Mandatory employee insurance to be rolled out across the country was that minute. So we got some thoughts and opinions on that one from Stephen McLaren, who joined us live on the show to give us his professional thoughts. We were also joined live on the show by Mamoun Hmedan, who is the Chief Business Officer, the CBO of Wego. They've seen a fourfold increase in demand for travel during the Eid break. That's going to be obviously one of the Ramadan travel trends. Are there others? Mamoun was kind enough to join us live in studio to give us his thoughts and all the latest numbers as well from Wego with regards to travel trends here in the region during the holy month of Ramadan. We're also taking a bit of an international perspective on things with Andy Critchlow. Andy's the head of news in the EMEA region for S&P Global Platts. He's actually over in Houston at the moment for the CIRA conference, the big energy conference that's taking place down in Texas. He's there as part of, wearing his S&P Global hat, of course, but was kind enough to join us live on the line to explain a few of the points that were being discussed at length at the event. And Tatiana Leskova, also in studio, credit analyst for S&P Global. It was a bit of an S&P Global day, wasn't it, for us? Not one, but two guests from S&P Global. But Tatiana was in to talk about a new trend that they'd noticed here in the region. In fact, she'd been crunching that data and had penned a new report saying that GCC telcos are needing to reinvent themselves as techcos. What does that mean? Well, we asked the author of the report. That's all right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. Brandy, bit of breaking news.
Yeah. So, inflation numbers. I'm having a look at some Emirates NBD analysis of them. For Dubai, they're out. We've got inflation easing slightly year on year for February to 3.4%, but rising by about half a percentage point month on month. Housing is still the big driver of inflation. Transport costs also increasing month to month. And I mean, we'll know the petrol price has gone up, so that is a big component of that. I've actually just messaged a friend, The Economist, to find out whether or not flights are in our CPI basket. I think they're not, but I do want to check whether aviation cost is in there. I don't think it is, because we've just had that interview with the guys from Wego who have talked about the spike in costs and the massive spike in demand for travel, not just for Ramadan and Eid, but that they have seen for the first 3 months of this year and expect to continue. Petrol prices feeding into transport costs, housing prices, as we know, are still punchy, but inflation overall easing slightly year on year.
Health insurance for private and domestic sector employees will become mandatory across the country from next year. Something you've been looking into this morning, Brandy.
Yeah, indeed. A couple of lines that have come out of a wide-ranging cabinet meeting talking about the cabinet approving a health insurance system for registered employees in the private sector as well as domestic workers, basically saying that employers needed to pay for health insurance. Gave us a bit of a pause here on the Business Breakfast because we thought, surely this is already happening. So we have one insurance broker on the line for us this morning. Stephen McLaren is Director of Corporate Solutions at Seven Insurance Brokers. Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Brandy.
So what's changed?
Well, it looks like it's going to be mandatory health insurance throughout the rest of the United Arab Emirates, whereas previously it started off in Abu Dhabi way back in 2006, and then Dubai caught up in 2015.
What could this mean for employers? What did we see happen when this came in for Dubai and Abu Dhabi?
Well, it's a transfer away from the government health card, and it means that employers will be paying a proportionately higher premium for medical insurance than they would have been before. So I think it means similar. I'm thinking it's going to be more like the way Dubai worked out, where there'll be a basic level policy. But this is all just subjective until we know more, because all I've seen so far is the few lanes that you've seen so far as well. The devil, will, as we say, will be in the detail.
OK. What could it mean for the cost of policies? What generally happens when these things become mandatory? Do they go up because effectively you've got some guaranteed business, or do you go down because of the quantity of that business?
There's two levels of it. There's the basic level policy that was down in Abu Dhabi, which is the mandatory one. There are players in the market, but demand's by far the largest, and they tend to go up. Dubai has been fairly stable at the moment for the participating insurers. So what Dubai did was they brought in only a certain number of insurers. It started with seven, were able to do the mandatory policy, and we're now up to 16. So for them, they're getting volume, and the premium's meant to keep, and it has been kept fairly low. The rest of the market definitely keeps going up, with medical inflation at 10 to 12%, depending which survey you look at.
We've also
seen, it's only going to mean premiums will continue to go up.
We've also seen quite the population influx over the last year or so. How have you seen that echoed in the insurance industry?
Everyone has to be covered, certainly in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And all I ever get is my own evidence and evidence in the media is that premiums are going up considerably all the time. You hear of individuals having higher increases than the corporate schemes themselves, and that seems to be a trend.
So what do you still want to know here, Stephen? As you say, it's all about the detail. As with many of these things, we have the broad brush detail at the moment, but we are waiting for the small print. What do you want to hear?
First of all, what's the minimum level of cover if there's such a thing provided? So a minimum table of benefits. Also, within the few lines that we were given was that it starts from the 1st of January 2025 and as residency visas are renewed. So normally in a group scheme, they would all come on board at one time. So that could signify that they will start from the 1st of January and bring on each individual as the visa is renewed. That would be strange for me on a group medical plan.
Stephen McLaren, Director of Corporate Solutions at Seven Insurance Brokers, joining us this morning. Thank you so much for your time. Just to talk through one of our top stories this morning, which is the expansion of mandatory insurance, health insurance, for those working in the private sector and in the domestic sector.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking Eid travel now. Eid al-Fitr flight searches out of the UAE up nearly fourfold, according to the guys at WeGo. We are joined by their Chief Business Officer, Mamoon Hamidan. Mamoon, it's lovely to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So what's your theory behind the jump?
So, yeah, this year is quite unique, I would say, compared to the previous years. We always witness Ramadan in summer, where basically, or at least the past few years, where people used to travel anyway and didn't really have that much of effect. That trend started to shift slowly. But this year is very unique because the Eid holiday and the spring holiday and the Easter holiday are all coming together, collectively giving people lots of reasons to travel. Schools are off for like almost three weeks. Families are ready to pack and go. Eid holiday this year is going to be very, very long. It's almost 9 days. So it's a full weekend to weekend, Friday to Sunday, basically. So that's definitely reflecting on the demand on travel, which was already at its peak, I would say, by the end of last year, beginning of this year. So we witnessed a very, very good first 2 months generally. Mm-hmm. But if I look at the data for this month only, we are 22% month over month. And I think that's going to keep on growing up until maybe it exceeds the 50% mark in terms of monthly
for
searches
March.
And bookings for March. And year on year, we are on 70%+. So same time last year, we were 70% less in terms of demand to travel. So generally, it looks very, very positive from that perspective. We were expecting to see very busy airports, very busy destinations, especially nearby destinations, especially destinations where, you know, visiting family or friends are quite trending, places like Jordan, Egypt, India, Pakistan, etc.
So people are searching. Are they booking, though? And what kind of prices are they booking at?
Well, actually, people are booking. Yes, I think usually for any search, we see bookings around 5%. Mm-hmm. So if we have million searches, then 5% of those will end up booking. The impact on prices is quite noticeable right now. I think on average, prices have increased by 15-16% versus same time last year, which was already at the peak. Month on month, we're exceeding 25%. But varies by destination as well, and the network and the coverage in terms of airlines covering the destination. For example, the UK, London as a destination, have increased actually by 23%, while places like Dusseldorf or Munich in Germany have increased by 63%. So just on a month-on-month basis. So it depends on demand, depends on the frequency of flights, and what type of carriers are there. Are we seeing any low-cost carriers helping or just the legacy ones extra?
So that's price. Can I get a seat, though, for Eid?
Until now, yes. I think you're late generally, but this market is very, very known for being a very last-minute market in terms of travel and planning and booking extra. Technically, you will. Depends on the destination, again, the coverage of the network. But to the Asian destination, where you have plenty of airlines and offers, I think you still can get a seat, but at a premium price for sure.
The price thing is interesting because we've spent the last year, year and a half talking about the cost of living. We've got the Dubai CPI numbers, the inflation numbers that have come out this morning that we're looking at. How price sensitive or not customers, when it comes to something like a 9-day Eid, are we just willing to pay it?
Well, good question, actually. I would say UAE is quite unique from that perspective. I cannot call it a price-sensitive market as a market. You know, compared to other markets that we operate in, I think it's less price-sensitive. It's more service-driven, I would say. People prefer, you know, the Emirates of the world and that sort of, you know, luxury experience by some of the legacy carriers over the low-cost carriers. Family travel is still a trend. Visiting family and friends is still a trend. People who wants to celebrate the last few days of Eid, of Ramadan and the Eid holiday with their families are still going to do it. Umrah is a big thing in Ramadan. So we see lots of traffic going to Saudi at the moment. So I don't think price will really make big difference on that trend. What we see as a continuous to grow trend that we assume that will slow down a little bit after COVID is the staycation, and that's continuously growing year after year. And I think it's going to continue to grow because of the weather fact every Ramadan, every Eid. So we see lots and lots of demands for places like, you know, the Yas Island in Abu Dhabi or Ras Al Khaimah or hotels in Dubai and resorts here. Even though, again, the price change impact is quite high and noticeable on those staycations.
Those booking percentage rises that you've seen, you know, month on month, year on year, up 70-odd%. Yeah. How long can that continue? What are you expecting to see for the whole of the year?
Well, technically, we think it's going to be a remarkable year, similar to 2019, right before COVID, where, you know, it was the highest year in terms of numbers of travel worldwide, globally. I think this year, 2024, is going to be that year where we're going to put 2019 behind in general. The trend is so high. Business travel is back. There are loads and loads of reasons for people to travel nowadays for business, especially in the region. So many events happening between Saudi, Egypt. Lots of investment, lots of opportunities, lots of business trips, and that will continue to increase, plus the leisure component as well. Keep in mind that we're going to have the Eid al-Adha, which is going to be the third week of June, and that will be right before the summer holiday. So again, we're going to have a very long summer holiday this year. So I would expect a surge to continue to grow.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning with all of those numbers. The Chief Business Officer of WeGo, Mahmoud Hamidan, forecasting, well, a very busy everything. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
This one might need a little explanation, but worry not, because we have the man in studio to do exactly that. He represents Sharuk Partners, obviously one of the most prominent venture and technology investors here in the MENA region. They have led a very successful $11 million funding round for Mantra. Who Mantra? Well, they're bringing things to market. The new capital injection is going to significantly foster a mission from Mantra to revolutionise RWAs, real-world asset tokenization on a global scale. As I said, the man who can help us with this one is a Forbes 30 Under 30 Kaufman Fellow, co-founding partner at Sharuk Partners, Shane Shin, joining us live in studio. Shane, really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us today. Let's start with the RWAs, if we can. A number of our listeners and viewers out there will be unaware with the acronym. How do you explain RWAs to the uninitiated?
So another way to say is it will be an integration of Web2 companies or traditional industries with the blockchain. So essentially, real world asset, as the name implies, it can bring regulated securities, regulated activities into the blockchain, into the crypto, so that we can form as an integration, and that will be a big thesis going forward. For example, real estate. Now, real estate can be tokenized or can be securitized in a blockchain way, and we can trade that in a public market through the blockchain world.
Sharuk Partners, obviously a leading investor in new technology, new trends for many, many years here in the region. They've been a real sort of game changer in that field. What's the house view on RWAs? Why are you excited by RWA?
So we believe we have always been a first mover advantage, especially in the fintech, led many investments in now one of the successful companies like Tamara to Club to Lean and Lendo and etc. We believe evolution of fintech will actually be this tracking $15 trillion of assets will be tokenized in the next one decade. So as a VC, we have a long-term view and we want to be the first mover advantage in innovating that trend. And we believe Mantra will be paving the way in the Middle East and also Asia.
A very competitive sector at the moment. As you say, a lot of VCs targeting this part of the world. Thankfully, you've been in the region for a lot longer and the Sharuk Partners brand is well known. What stood out from Mantra, though? What made them stand out from the crowd?
There are about three key elements. First, many people will say they target the RWA sector, but they do not know really how to be regulated, how to be compliant, and how to execute on their vision. We have been following Mantra's journey for some time now, and we know that they are in process to go through the regulation at the moment, and they are taking extremely transparent and the serious approach stance on that compliance. So that is one thing. Second, we also know that the company has been around for more than 4 years, went through quite a few cycles, and they have been steadfast to working on this vision. This vision is not easy to actually execute on. So we respect the team's journey, team's vision, and the resilience to get to that. And that this is why we also want to support to enable that vision.
We know that companies like Mantra have multiple offices in multiple regions as well. We know that this region has been very forward-thinking, proactive when it comes to regulation in this field as well and promoting blockchain in the way
Absolutely.
Forward. Is there a need, and is there a house view from Sharuk that you know you need to start bridging regions at the moment to bring this regulation together?
So fortunately, we have always had that vision and a mission of bridging the gap between Middle East with the rest of the world. Mm. Even the founding partner of Sharuk, myself as a Korean, also Mahmoud as Emirati, we met in the U.S. So we consider that as our fulfilling mission. And the founder and the team with offices in, and talk about Mantra, the offices in Dubai and Hong Kong actually literally fulfill that vision. And as you mentioned, Dubai is actually the world leader on the blockchain space. That means we have a lot more talents we can tap into. Hong Kong actually has always been a leader globally before Dubai really is making its wave. So that means, again, ecosystem is thriving, ecosystem is vibrant, and which is very important in the blockchain industry.
Blockchain is something that's been well addressed here in the region with good reason as well. Tokenization is a phrase as well that so many more people are becoming aware of here. Is the rest of the world alive to the potential of tokenization or not?
Absolutely. So actually, US has been already leading fund asset managers globally, like BlackRock, Larry Fink, CEO, actually has stated publicly that this is the future and BlackRock is going every big and making deep moves into the tokenization world. So I actually think we need to play catch up and we need to play catch up fast.
Shripan is certainly doing that with their latest lead on this one, helping with a successful 11 million funding round at Mantra. What's the rest of the year look like, Shane, for Shroop Partners? Is it going to be a busy one?
Absolutely. We truly believe Region is at the right, the forefront to make the best leading investments. We are extremely busy and occupied with finding the next set of A-plus founders, next set of innovative trends, so that we can take that first mover advantage.
Just, I mean, given your international experience, and you have worked across the world in investment and VC and in various offices around the world, why is this region experiencing such a bounce at the moment?
So when I first came to Dubai 2017, I was very confident Middle East is one of the largest untapped VC market globally. Like, we always talk about India, Southeast Asia, perhaps even China, which now we talked about. Middle East, we saw a potential. We have a population. We also have a capital market. And we also have a great set of founders. We just needed some push to catalyze that. And now the last 5 years, you know what sovereign funds, family offices, corporates, and private fund managers like us, we all converged to make this innovation happen. And it's only at the start. Today, we're about $3 to $4 billion VC market here in the Middle East. I truly believe we're going to get to $10 billion in the next 7 years by 2030, which now at $10 billion, we're one of the largest globally. And we only got there in 12 years or so.
So plenty to look forward to.
Absolutely.
Plenty to keep you busy as
yes,
well, Shane.
That's right.
Listen, congratulations on the deal and the relationship with Mantra. Thanks so much indeed for coming in to explaining it a little bit more to us. And a huge thanks to Shane Shin, the co-founding partner of Shahrukh Partners.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's get more on one of our top stories now. The warning from S&P that telcos, the likes of Etisalat here in the region, have got to reinvent themselves from telcos to techcos. The lead author of that report is Tatiana Leskova. She's a credit analyst with S&P Global Ratings here in Dubai, and she's in the studio. Tatiana, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Let's talk first of all about the problem facing these big giant telcos like Etisalat here, Ooredoo in Qatar, STC in Saudi Arabia. You say in your report, telecom markets in the region are mature, which limits their growth to about 1.3% annually. Tell us more.
Yeah, no, that's right. We have very high mobile penetration rates in the region, ranging between 130 to over 200%, which suggests very mature mobile markets. And the growth actually we forecast domestically in the region from something ranging between 1 to 3%. And these companies have more ambition than that, so they would like to grow faster. In the traditional telecom space, they face some issues, structural decline in fixed voice, for instance, in messaging. There's a lot of competition in this space, so they need to find new ways to grow. And one of them is to develop non-telecom revenue streams.
So just how bad is the revenue from telephone calls at the moment? I mean, when I was growing up, I'm not that old, but they were called telephone companies because that was pretty much what they did. You made telephone calls. Does anyone make telephone calls anymore? Does Etisalat or STC actually make any money from phone calls?
Oh, of course, of course. And this is the main profit driver for them, and that's the main revenue driver as well for the telecom operators. But they want to stay relevant and they, you know, forward-looking. So mobile revenues are growing, the subscriber numbers are growing, but there is competitive pressure. So if you look at the average revenue per mobile user, it's under pressure. It's going down slightly. If you look on over a long historical period. The issue really is in the fixed voice calls. Nobody's using fixed lines at home anymore, or this utilization is going down. And messaging, because there's a lot of competition from voice over internet protocol apps, be it WhatsApp and you name there's a long list of them.
I mean, I haven't got my telecom bill in front of me from my provider. Mm. I'm pretty sure I pay them far more every year for data than I do for phone calls. Couldn't tell you the breakdown. And similarly at home, I haven't had a landline for decades. No. The only bill I pay every month to my provider is for internet and a bit of TV. And I guess that's fairly typical, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. And actually, increasing data consumption is one of the key revenue drivers also. More so in emerging regions where you have lower data consumption rates, but that's what's driving their revenues, and that's why they keep investing in 5G, for instance, to support higher data consumption in the future.
Okay, so I get the problem. Very low growth rates in the saturated traditional telco market. Fine. But reinventing yourself as a techco, not easy. We know, for example, Etisalat is trying to do that. Hence the rebrand from Etisalat to E&. They call themselves now a technology company. Rebranding is relatively easy. Shiny new logo, happy days, tick the box. But for Hatem Dawida, the CEO and the team, actually doing it is harder. So what are companies like that actually doing? What's working? What is not working?
So listen, they've been doing it for many years, but there's been a boost a few years ago. They came out, I'm talking for the telecom companies that we rate in the region. In 22, three of them made significant announcements around strategy changes, really repositioning themselves as techcos. They did rebrand, they did corporate reorganization where they actually defined new business verticals. So they really carved out telecoms versus everything that is non-telecom, so digital verticals. They grow organically and they grow externally. So they invest themselves, they create these businesses, but it's also an easier, faster way for them to grow externally, so they would do M&A.
So in simple terms, what kind of things are they investing in? A tech company covers a very broad spectrum. Are they going to be making GPUs like NVIDIA? Do they want to be the next Google? What do they want to be?
Yes, no, probably not GPUs, but it's a wide range of services, you're right. It's essentially cybersecurity, data centers, Internet of Things, and a big focus on fintech, which addresses a very large expat population.
We know that Etisalat has a venture capital division and has had for some time now. They were an early investor in Careem, you were pointing out to me earlier before we came on air. And we've had the guys from EN Capital in the studio as well, and they are investing in fintech companies as well. But can that move the needle for giant companies like Etisalat and STC?
So listen, I think in terms of revenue generation, probably yes. If they were to combine organic internal growth and external growth, yes, that can become very material. I think the target E&. Announced is by 2030, they will generate 40% of revenue of tech costs, which is ambitious. But we think it's doable.
It's what percentage?
40.
40.
Yes, 40.
So this is interesting that you're convinced there's some substance to this. Because I go back to my earlier point, you can get a rebranding company to give you a new logo and a new corporate name and a new vision statement. You can hire McKinsey or Boston Consulting Group to give you a new strategy document, say we're going to do this. But you're a ratings analyst. You and the team at S&P and others like you have to strip out all the puff, all the grandstanding and the big statements and look at the actual substance of the company to give them a rating. Are you A2? Are you triple B minus or whatever it may be? So when you do that, when you strip out all the marketing spin, what do you see?
What we see is that if the contribution from non-telecom digital revenue keeps increasing, which we think is doable, this can improve the cash flow generation capacity of telecom operators because tech and digital is less asset intensive as telecom. So they don't have to build towers. So this leaves more cash flows. But it's also less profitable. So these are things we have to factor in the future ratings development. So the margin will go down a little bit.
But they do only got about a minute left, but they do still have to carry on investing. And you said capital intensive, billions upon billions, 5G infrastructures here, but there'll be 6G, there'll be 7G, who knows what next. And these incredibly expensive things to do, but they're going to have to carry on doing that, yeah?
Yes, they will have to, but you have to bear in mind that regional telcos have a lot of financial firepower. They have low leverage, they are very profitable compared to global telcos, so they generate a lot of cash to fund future investment.
And they do have either monopolies or duopolies often in their home markets.
Exactly. Regulatory frameworks are very supportive, so the competition is way more disciplined than in many other regions.
And 30 seconds going overseas. Often I turn up in the Maldives and it's welcome to a redo or something like that. Yeah. Is that a big deal for them?
Yes, we've seen a series of acquisitions, you know, directly and indirectly. E&. Acquired telecom operations in Europe from PPF, but they also acquired indirect stakes in Vodafone, so direct stake in Vodafone, giving exposure to Europe. And STC acquired a 9.9 stake in Telefonica, a Spanish operator. So, and they also acquired towers in Europe, so they have a way more ambition than just digital revenues.
Tatiana, great talk to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Tatiana Lesko over there, credit analyst with S&P Global Ratings, the lead author of the report, that says telcos in the GCC must reinvent themselves as techcos.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Emirates looking for 5,000 more cabin crew. That is going to up their numbers by around a quarter. I've been speaking to the woman in charge of finding them, Samantha James, who started as crew herself, is now vice president of the airline of cabin crew. She's been talking to me about why they need them.
So 5,000 cabin crew, as Emirates is the number one airline in the world. We are looking to expand our network. As you know, we've just made an order for 65 A350 aircraft, and we have on order 205 777Xs. So we want to make sure that we have the resource on board the aircraft to make sure that we can connect our customers globally around the world.
And what kind of time frame have you got to find them all?
So I'm looking at the next 12 months to look at those 5,000 cabin crew moving forward.
How do you go about finding 5,000 people? What's the process?
So 5,000 cabin crew, we have our wonderful Emirates website, career website, which is has a dedicated page for cabin crew. The individual can apply through the website, and on the back end, we have amazing recruitment and systems that support us, that we review every application that is coming through.
With a person?
With a person, to make sure that we respond and invite those individuals that are eligible.
So how many applications would you normally receive?
So if I look at just in the last 20 months, we've had 1.5 million applications that have come through to Emirates. For
all have
crew.
Been, and all of those have been read by an actual recruiter?
And all of those have been shortlisted and reviewed by an Emirates recruiter.
So how do you decide who makes the cut? What's the tipping factor?
So we have an eligibility which, first of all, you've got to be able to read, speak and write English, have a minimum height of 160 centimetres, be able to reach 212 centimetres, have hospitality, yeah, in order to make sure that you can, you know, assist our customers with their baggage, also being able to reach our safety equipment that's in the overhead lockers. Someone who has hospitality, customer service background, and someone who is a team player.
What skills, though, jump out for you? I mean, OK, height, all the rest of it, great, but what is it?
For me, it's being a team player, someone who comes from a hospitality background, someone who's in the customer service industry, individuals who are coming from our hospitality schools or even postgraduates, because it's an amazing opportunity for them to start their careers with Emirates.
But you're not the only people looking for them. We've spoken to an awful lot of people about the war for talent, about staff shortages in hospitality, hotels, coming out of COVID. How hard do you find it to find staff?
For me, it's not a challenge. We are the number one international airline and the largest international airline in the world. Dubai is the number one city that everybody's relocating to. So for me, it hasn't been a challenge to attract talent. It's the challenge we have is that we want to be able to respond to all those applicants.
You're competing now, though, against a lot of airlines as well. The aviation industry going through a big boom at the moment. You've got a competitor coming down the road in the shape of Riyadh Air. How do you convince people that it's Emirates and not someone else?
For me, it's about the perks that we offer our cabin crew and the opportunity to have a career path with Emirates, and I can attest to that. So some of the perks that we offer you is, you know, competitive salary with flying pay, accommodation that is furnished, excellent medical, dental and life insurance, also the opportunity to learn and upskill yourselves in customer service.
Okay, well, look, let's break that down into a couple of parts. Has the salary gone up from pre-COVID?
So salary has gone up. So an average baseline for a new recruit coming in will be around, for their basic pay, about 4,430 dirhams, plus their flying pay. So on average per month, they're taking around 10,170 dirhams away, and that's in their own pocket. So because we provide the furnished accommodation, the transport to and from work, laundry services, iconic uniform, that money is really theirs.
Has the pay gone up because of living expenses? We know cost of living has been a huge topic this year, or is it also competition that you need to offer a bit more?
For me, I think this is something that Emirates does really well. We're always reviewing the pay scale and what we offer our employees coming into the business.
You spoke about career progression there. I mean, you yourself started off in the galley. You started off as cabin crew. How long do people typically stay cabin crew, and what can you do for them to move them through the company?
Okay. So on average, a cabin crew can be anything like myself. I started with the airline 27 years ago. I didn't stay cabin crew all that time, but within 13 years, I actually made that transition myself to come into cabin crew management. But you start off as an economy crew member. You normally spend around 15 to 18 months as an economy crew member before you progress into business class, further into first class, and then into the leadership roles, which is the cabin supervisor role and the purser role. So sometimes you can see someone progress into the purser role within 8 years.
We do hear a lot about what younger generations want from jobs compared to the generations before. Are you finding that's a conversation that you're having more? How are the newer generations reacting to the role and what they want from it?
So the newer generations are coming to me saying they're coming for a career. I think years gone by that people came to see the world, travel around the world, and live a certain lifestyle, which is very unique. Now, the new generation are coming in. They're really looking for what is in it for me and what career can I come out with Emirates.
And that is Samantha James, who is the Vice President of Cabin Crew at Emirates. Speaking of career, I mean, we're talking there about younger recruits wanting to come in and know that there is a path. Sam herself is a great example of that. She was telling me after the interview that she meets absolutely every cabin crew, new member, new joinee, herself in person, shakes their hand. She started off as crew. She's worked her way up. She's now a vice president at the airline. And in terms of progression, she was telling me that Emirates has done stuff like sent her off to study at the University of Warwick in the UK, sent her off to INSEAD at Singapore to study business management. So it's a good story. It's a good sales tool, isn't it? I liked it.
It's a good economic indicator as well, isn't it? You know, demand for jobs in the region. The majority of those 5,000 will be based here or certainly spending a lot of time here.
And in that war for talent, and there absolutely is in that space, because all those people they're going to hire, you can be darn sure that Etihad would like to have them, that the Qatar Airways would like to have them, not to mention Tony Douglas and the new airline in Riyadh would like to have them. So they're going to get some good offers. And they're all going to be paying, I would imagine, broadly similar packages. That's fine. So when you're making that decision, you hear stories like that and you think about a 27-year career. Those are the kind of things that people make decisions on, aren't they? Not everyone will make a decision on that. Some will say, I just really want to live in Abu Dhabi, so I'm going to work for Etihad, and that's fine. But people who are thinking, right, okay, I want a career, not a job. For those people, and they're a significant, probably minority, but a significant minority, there you go.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's the fact that one of the things that grabbed me was just the fact that it's like, okay, you know, you want to study, we're going to send you off to study. INSEAD is one of the most expensive places that you can study. To me, that shows a bit of commitment.
Oh, no question at all. Yeah, investing in staff, again, pushes all the right buttons. Not everyone is going to get to do that. Not everyone will have that kind of career progression, of course. But to know it's there, to know it's possible is, I mean, can I say inspiring? Am I getting a bit carried away? I think it is inspiring. You need those inspirational stories, don't you, to think, okay, fine, yeah, you work at McDonald's. You know, one of the CEOs started flipping burgers and worked his way up to be the CEO. Those stories matter. They really do.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.